Hello and welcome to another Sustainable Wine Roundtable podcast. My name is Toby Webb. I'm one of the founders of the SWR. And joining me in today's podcast is our friend of SWR, Etel Higone. Welcome to the podcast, Etel. How are you?
It's such a pleasure to be here with you.
Well, thanks for joining us. Now, SWR listener, Etel is a friend of ours, as we might say, an ambassador for SWR. And she's working with us to help us understand how we can use nature better to enhance resilience in vineyards, manage risk, and ideally, we'd like to come up at one point with a plan for driving nature investments in vineyards, and maybe even coming up with a business model and an incentive for it. But while we're working on that, Etel and I thought we'd have a chat about some amazing recent work she's done to raise awareness of the idea of vitiforestry in vineyards. And this is something that's known about in environmental circles, but perhaps may not be as well known as it could be in wine. So, Etel, amongst your many things that you've worked on over the years, vitiforestry has been one of them. You've created this library, which we will link to so that listeners can go and find all the resources that you have assembled about this. But just tell us briefly, Etel, what are we talking about when we talk about vitiforestry, and why is it important?
Toby, in a nutshell, vitiforestry is agroforestry for wine. So it's kind of the art and science of mixing trees and hedgerows in and around your vineyard. So why is it a great idea? I mean, there are so many reasons, but let's start with the top line reasons. Ecologically, monoculture is both dangerous and really, I think, a very modern invention that is leading us into a kind of Russian roulette that we're playing with our planet. Ecologically, monoculture means that you open yourself up to pests sweeping through a crop, but also monoculture kind of drains the soil of its nutrients. It harms the soil. In contrast, when you have agroforestry, it heals the soil, it keeps the soil rich, it develops this incredible network of fungi underground that will protect your crops, actually. And agroforestry, when it's done right, it creates barriers to wind. So, it's not just that monoculture will hurt your crops in the long run because it impoverishes the soil. Monoculture kind of creates these sort of windswept deserts in a way that are particularly harmful for certain crops like grapes. Grapes really don't like to be windswept and desiccated. It doesn't help with any kind of wine. It's not just, the sort of highest end wine. It's any kind of wine can really suffer. The quality of your wine is at stake here. And what trees do is they provide shelter and wind barriers in a way that is actually going to be more and more important as we get superstorms and progressively weirder wind patterns. But let's delve into another aspect of how a sort of turbocharged climate change can hurt your crops and how agroforestry, vitiforestry in vineyards can help. Trees are actually temperature regulators. Think of them as both cooling when it's hot, but also warming mechanisms for when it's cold. We do these crazy things in wine, right? Where we get helicopters to go above our vineyards and blow down the hot air. We have braziers going. We do insane things when frosts come at critical moments to endanger our harvest. And actually, trees have a radiative effect where they can kind of keep the warmth of your vineyard at a more stable level. And that is the less obvious thing that they do when they're thought of as temperature regulators. But more obviously, you walk under trees when it's hot on a summer day, it's cool. It feels cool and it is cool. It's not just for you, it's also for your grapes. So trees can play an incredibly important role in protecting vineyards from the droughts and heat domes that we think are going to only get worse and worse with climate chaos. We've seen in the last couple of years, this is really threatening the wine industry and agriculture more generally. So, yeah, they are protection from wind, They are protection from frost. They are protection from heat. Interestingly, for wine specifically, we have mite outbreaks in vineyards that are particularly bad for certain kinds of wine. And trees will limit the dust that contributes to mite outbreaks. So if you are in a region or an appellation that has dust problems, again, trees are your friends. It really helps the freshness of grapes because of trees' transpiration. Trees are essentially rain and water machines, right? I mean, we all know that trees are the lungs of the planet. They breathe in carbon and breathe out oxygen, but it's less well known that they're a transpiration system. And so grapes' freshness is actually enhanced as well. All that means that in the end, your Brix, your density, your acidity, these factors will really improve and benefit from agroforestry. And then, last but not least, for anybody who's struggling with rot in their vineyard, trees create a more resilient microbiome. And in particular, when you have lots of hedges, like a little donut around your vineyard, this is a key thing that will help to fight rot. And part of it is just because they help with soil water holding capability. But there's a whole variety of reasons. Some trees, if you're quite careful about what you plant and how, will attract exactly the bats that eat exactly the pests that are proliferating and hurting your vineyard. So depending on what problems you're facing, pests, rot, acidity, freshness, drought, vitiforestry is a powerful tool to save your vineyard, and it just really does great things for carbon sequestration. It makes you eligible for carbon and biodiversity credits. And trees and vitiforestry systems can boost the biodiversity of your vineyard immensely. So if you're doing ecotourism, that's also a huge plus.
Great. So in a moment, I want to ask you about what should a vineyard owner do next if they are convinced by your argument, which I am, but I don't own a vineyard and I haven't got 50 hectares of monoculture out my window. And I'd like to know what I should do about that from your point of view. But before you talk about that, Tel, what have you done as a partial solution here? You've put together a library of resources, which we are going to link and send out with this podcast, at least in the show notes. Just tell the listener, though, what could they expect when they look at that? What have you put together?
I decided, as a kind of service to the Sustainable Wine Roundtable in particular and the wine industry in general, to create a free public electronic library with every single peer-reviewed scientific paper about vitiforestry that I could find in English and French, Spanish, Portuguese, German, you name it, and also all the manuals and guides. So if you decide, oh, I'm listening to this podcast, I'm intrigued, I'm interested, but I don't know if I want to transition all or even part of my vineyards to agroforestry, let me find out more. Instead of you having to slog in an endless search of Google and YouTube and library visits, I've tried to make a one-stop shop where wineries, vineyards, people who are interested in buying wine at scale and getting carbon credits or insetting for their company can just go. They can read all the science that's out there. If they don't want to read all the science, they can read just the abstracts and they can find all the manuals. I've also created a sort of nook inside the agroforestry wine e-library where I put all the media reports and videos that I could find. So, even if you don't want to read some dry scientific papers, you can just read all the media reports. And one thing that I'm going to try to do is create a map with little pins every place that there's an agroforestry project in wine, so that if you want to do vitiforestry, you could just hop in your car or a train or bike and go visit the closest vitiforestry vineyard around and see with your own eyes. I think sometimes reading about things is useful. Sometimes watching videos is useful, but sometimes also just seeing what other people are already doing. And Toby, there are so many people that are already doing vitiforestry. The good news is, if you're interested and you're intrigued, there's a lot of science to help you do this right. And there's a lot of folks whose footsteps you can follow in. So you'll be standing on the shoulders of giants.
Yes, it's amazing when you see it up close. A couple of years ago, I went to see some of the estates in Portugal, some of which are up to 1,000 hectares, with say 50 hectares of grapes, and the wine pays pretty much for the upkeep of the rest of the estate, which features cork oak, features all sorts of really helpful uses of nature to hold the landscape together. And also, obviously, cork oak is harvested. There are other trees as well. So it's very much mixed land use. But without the vines there, there's 1,000 hectares that would struggle to be maintained. And that's one example, I guess, just in Portugal, where you have these kind of unique cork oak and vine landscapes. But there are many others. So before we talk about what someone could do next, what are some of the examples you've seen that tell of this being put into action?
Well, I could nerd out here for a second and talk about the ancient origins of vines. Back in the day, Toby, like in Roman times, in the Middle Ages, the only way to grow vines was in vitiforestry systems. If you look at paintings, old paintings, Vitis vinifera grew on trees before trellis systems were invented. The ancient Roman system, arbusta, actually used trees as living trellises. So the truth is that vine and trees fit together evolutionarily, in all grape growing regions of the world throughout history until just 200 years ago. And that's when things really changed and we moved into the trellis system. So if you look in history, it's everywhere. But if you look today, around 1.5% of US farms, vineyards are using agroforestry, reportedly. So one of the most famous is Abbot Claim, which is in a heavily wooded estate in Oregon. But there's also a little bit of agroforestry in the Bonterra estate in Mendocino, USA. And there's Centralas wine in like next to Los Angeles. Then in France, maybe one of the most famous estates in Saint-Émilion is the Château Cheval Blanc, which is vitiforestry. Château Antonique in Bordeaux, which is Mouilly-en-Médoc in the sort of left bank of the Bordeaux region of France, is vitiforestry. But I could go on and on. Château Bournac, Château d'Arche, Château de Piot, Château du Vivier, Château l'Estrige. There's so many. And in Italy, there's Di Filippo wines in Canada. We even see some agroforestry in Champagne, the Domaine Dumont. In South Africa, Graham Beck does it. Wherever you are, there are wonderful agroforestry models. If you're in Chile, Viña Tarapacá, all over the world, you go there, we can help you connect to people who are doing agroforestry wine and thriving. Because I think it's an inspiration to see other people doing it, and it helps demystify and break the ice, so to speak.
Wonderful. Thank you for the examples, Attell. SWR is shortly to launch our members forum, where members can get together and discuss issues like this. And this sounds like a perfect place where we can share this information. And so, listener, if you haven't already joined the Sustainable Wine Roundtable, then you really should, because shortly you'll be able to access all of the conversations that we have with members around things like this and share knowledge about it. So thank you for those examples, Attell. You mentioned Italy, and I can remember the first time I went to Barolo, and you see those signs in Piedmont that says Corsia nella nebbia, and of course Nebbiolo is named after La Nebbia, the fog, and you drive up these incredible kind of almost cartoon-looking hills, sort of perfect stereotypical small hills, and then you see the vines everywhere and the lights shining. And the first time I went there, I thought, wow, what an incredible view. And the last time I went there, I thought, what an incredible view of monoculture. And that does change your perspective when you realize that landscape is not as beautiful as you thought it was. It's just a monoculture, even though, the light is wonderful and the views are nice. So if we talk about somewhere like Piedmont, where you have all these rolling hills, this tremendously beautiful landscape, but covered in monoculture, how would a producer there get started? Because you can't just suddenly go and plonk a bunch of trees in the middle of your vineyard where, you've spent up to 20, 30 years, maybe longer, getting these vines exactly the way you want. How do you get started in a situation like that, do you think, with agroforestry?
There's so many different ways I like to break it down into zebras, donuts, and raindrops, just for starters. If you want to plant hedgerows and trees all around your vineyard so that you create these windbreaks and you create little sort of lines of biodiversity and carbon sequestration and shade and healthy soils all around each parcel, that's a great way to start. That's, I think of that as the donut model. But there's also enormous benefits to thinking about the zebra model. It is a myth that trees will compete with vines. When you place trees in the wrong way, okay, maybe they will compete with vines, but we're not talking about stupid agroforestry here. We're talking about clever agroforestry, well-done vitroforestry. We endorse good, solid, scientifically sound, data-driven agroforestry. And so if you do that, then you plan it right. With 30 to 40 trees per hectare, there's basically no competition for water between the trees and the vines. And in fact, with the climate getting warmer and warmer, places like Piedmont, I mean, all over Europe, we've seen these heat domes, we've seen droughts, we've seen crazy fires everywhere. Your trees will, in a sense, protect you from that, right? So that's the zebra model, these lines where you have little lines of trees. And it doesn't have to be a perfect, grid like a New York street, which is why I call it a zebra, because zebra stripes are a little bit more uneven and natural, and they follow the curve of the landscape. You can adjust them as needed, depending on the humidity and sun and the angle of your hillside. And so besides the donut model and the zebra model, there's little island models. You can have raindrops or islands, tiny raindrops, or little islands like Miyawaki forests that you place in spots that are not particularly valuable in terms of your best, most productive space for your vines. But if there's a slightly rockier spot or a spot that's shaded in the wrong way for the vines, these kind of little raindrops or little Miyawaki forests, little islands of forest, is also going to have just huge positive impacts for biodiversity, for soil health, for carbon sequestration. And I would say if you're just getting started, the most important thing is don't panic. Sit down and read as much of the material as you can in the agroforestry wine library, in the vitiforestry library. Go visit the closest places to you that are currently doing vitiforestry. Take a look. Get a feel for it and start as soon as you can, because the best time to plant a tree was 20 years ago, and the second best time is now.
So, with regard to things like hedgerows, when does a hedgerow become agroforestry? I mean, it's an argument about definitions, I suppose, but I mean, hedges grow faster. There's an awful lot of woody growth that can be very helpful for nature and climate that isn't necessarily a tree. So, where do you draw the line? Or do you?
It's interesting because there are certification schemes in other crops. When we think about chocolate, for example, or coffee, the certification bodies in cocoa and coffee have extremely careful, thought-through definitions of what is agroforestry, how much of it can be bushes, how much of it can be trees, how many canopy heights you have to have, whether they have to be all native species or you can have some invasive species of trees that you mix into your cocoa and coffee. In wine, the certification schemes are just asleep at the switch. They have not really thought through what agroforestry means for wine. So there aren't really great, carefully elaborated, data-driven, scientifically sound thresholds in wine certification bodies around where does vitiforestry begin and end? What is a hedgerow versus, trees that count as, a vitiforestry system? What if I have a vineyard and I do a donut around my vineyard and that donut is mostly hedges but also has a bunch of trees in them? How many trees? What percentage shade? These questions, they really are not carefully elaborated in the certification bodies for wine. I would say I'm just a huge believer in getting started with whatever you can do. If you can do hedgerows, do hedgerows. If you can plant trees in those hedgerows, do that. For those listeners and wine growers who are in Europe, which is a huge percentage of the global wine industry, obviously, there's another consideration, which is this new European law about protecting nature in Europe and bringing back biodiversity, nature, forests, and rivers in Europe. A good idea if you're a European farmer, if you're a European vineyard manager or owner, is to think about compliance with that law. So when you're thinking hedgerow versus tree, it probably wouldn't affect your certification one way or the other, and no certification in wine will tell you. You can look at the science in the Agroforestry Vineyard Library will give you a sense of what you should do, but also think about how you can begin to comply with European law. Some of that law, we know that hedgerows go towards compliance, and we also know that trees go towards compliance. So it's really important, I think, to plan out how you can be in compliance with EU law if you're operating in Europe.
Yes, there's going to be an interesting trend in the coming years about demonstrating your positive footprint on nature and therefore getting perhaps preferred supplier status for retailers and others. I mean, we're working on a global reference framework for wine standards, and we will be including as much as we can around improving agroforestry and asking the standards where they are with it and the certification bodies to see how we can raise awareness of it because for all the reasons you outlined, it's a good idea. And buyers of wine will want to see more and more of that. In fact, one leading retailer in about 2 weeks' time is going to launch their nature strategy for wine suppliers, for grape growers. And it's going to include a lot on this. I can't say who it is yet, it's all embargoed, but I think it's going to happen on the 21st or 22nd of this month of March. We'll be highlighting it in our future updates. And the reason they're doing it is to drive climate resilience. And so they can make sure that they can start thinking about how they meet their own climate targets by driving the sequestering of carbon and enhancing nature in their vineyards. And if you look at the EU Nature Restoration Law, it aims to restore at least 20% of the EU's land and sea areas by 2030. And countries who have signed up for it, it's been passed now, so that'll be all EU nations, will need to restore 30% of habitats that are already degraded by 2030, 60% by 2040, and 90% by 2050. So, given that grape growing takes up quite a large area of agricultural land in Europe, yet is not an essential food crop, much as we might think a glass of wine is essential, demonstrating, as you say, demonstrating how it's contributing to nature enhancement is going to be a very, very important thing for the wine industry. So, what would you like to? Sorry.
I think that's right. And actually, to your point about certifications and the Nature Restoration Law, I think what you and Sustainable Wine Roundtable are doing to hold the certifications in wine accountable and sort of pressure them to all up their game and be more comprehensive, less higgledy-piggledy, more serious across every major issue instead of having these big gaps here, there, everywhere. I think that's incredibly important. But I also believe that for a lot of European wine growers, if the certification schemes don't start to ensure that you're in compliance with the EU Nature Restoration Law, the certification schemes are going to get less and less useful, right? Because doing compliance for the law on the one hand and compliance for the certification scheme on the other creates this double burden for wine growers. So I would be shocked if the certification schemes don't start to feel a great deal of pressure to help all the companies that they certify get in compliance with the EU Nature Restoration Law when they are in the EU. And actually, if you're a company, whether your sustainability certification does or doesn't, you probably do just want to get into compliance. And let's talk not just about the stick, but also the carrot, Toby. Of course, it's true that this new law was passed, which is hugely important. But also, there's been for the last decade a huge amount of buzz around carbon offsetting, carbon insetting, carbon credits, and more recently, biodiversity credits. I think for wine growers who want to be in compliance with EU law, that's one thing. But for wine growers and companies, vineyards that are thinking about their carbon, vitiforestry offers an enormously interesting and useful path. Essentially, if you can figure out how to roll out vitiforestry for your company, you might be able to get carbon credits for it, you might be able to get biodiversity credits for it, and you might be able to get both. So I think it's important to talk about the carrot as well as the stick. And for forward-looking, innovative, creative front runners in the wine space, to really be out there, be bold, and get those credits. Don't let other industries, you know, arrive there first and eat up all the credits. You're in a position, I think, in the wine space to dominate.
Yes, I think two quick points on that from the SWR point of view. First is on the wine standards and certifications. You're right, they do have holes in them, some of them. For example, some of them don't cover things like minimum labor standards. And we asked them why not, and they said, oh, it's because it's covered by national law, so we don't have to worry about it. Well, actually, you do have to worry about it because not everybody's in compliance with national law. They just haven't been caught yet. And so we'll be pushing on behalf of our retail members, which now represent more than 1 billion bottles of wine a year. We'll be asking them to raise their game and not have gaps. And just as labour standards has been a gap, so is nature restoration and vitiforestry. So we'll be making sure as much as we can that we reflect the holistic needs of our retail and distributor members who want the standards to be as inclusive and comprehensive as possible. And this is a key issue in doing that. So we'll see how that plays out. It's going to take us a little while to put that in action, but it's a key focus because we can't have an assessment scheme for wine standards that has holes in it. And just equally as we can't have a gap on labour standards, we can't have a gap on vitiforestry either. So that's something we're going to be doing. And on the second point around insetting, if listeners are not familiar with insetting, you are familiar, I'm sure, with the controversies around offsetting. And there are some good offset projects out there under things like Red Plus and others. But I think it's fairly clear that the land for offsetting is pretty limited. And double counting is not allowed. And I don't think if we can find great quality carbon credits in 5 years' time, none of you will be able to afford them, because they will all be bought. And in fact, they are being bought already by companies with a far more horrible carbon footprint problem than wine companies have. Oil companies, shipping companies, airlines, they're buying up the high quality carbon credits because they know that they're going to need them. So the likes of the wine industry will not be able to afford high quality carbon credits, even if they can find them in 5 years' time, which brings us to your point, Patel, about insetting. And insetting can use the fact that wine is inherently traceable to enable insetting in wine. And insetting effectively says, if you're a wine retailer and you have an unavoidable carbon footprint that you can't cancel by, you know, having electrified transport and LED lighting and the most efficient systems in what we call scope one, scope two of carbon emissions calculations, your emissions are in scope three, which is where things are grown and made. And so you're going to need to compensate for that. And what we would like to see is retailers working out with us at SWR a carbon price and a nature premium, for example. We could create a fund, or we could help the creation of a fund to happen, which could then use wine's inherent traceability to put money into the supply chain to say, let's sequester carbon and enhance nature on these farms, in these wine growing areas. And because it's traceable, we should be able to know using technology pretty easily just how much progress is being made, which should then allow those retailers and distributors to say, we're making a difference to our carbon footprint, because what we can't cut to zero, we are making a difference over here by putting in financing that allows for carbon to be sequestered and for nature to be enhanced in the region of Catalonia, in the region of Bordeaux, in the region of Piedmont. And here's the evidence that supports that, which will be driven by technology. Now, that in turn would drive compliance with the Nature Restoration Law, And I think it'd be of great interest in terms of preferred pricing, sorry, preferred supply for retailers. Because in the future, retailers are going to want to sell wine that's not only entirely traceable, but has its impacts traceable as well. And so that's where we'd like to get to with SWR. Etel and I have been talking about this for a year or two, which you might have picked up from our conversation. All of that that we've just spoken about, listener, is going to take a while. But at the very least, I think what Etel and I are suggesting here is let's get started, as you said, Etel. And we will post a link to your compendium of resources, and we should put it front and center on the website and in the newsletter, which we should have done a while ago. So apologies for that, but we can do it now. And so, yeah, just to finish off, I suppose, Etel, what would you suggest those listening do? I mean, but they can go into the drive, the resource that we're going to post, read everything. But what are some of the other resources they might look to if they want to get started?
I think this might sound a little bit cheesy, but people can look into their heart and find their courage to do their own bit however they can. I'm really a glass half full person. I don't believe in beating yourself up. I don't believe in, whinging about how problems are too large for us to fix. I think each one of us has so much creativity and beauty and power. If we look into our hearts and we roll up our sleeves and we say, okay, the past is the past. Maybe I didn't do things as well as I could have in the past. That's over. I'm going to focus on the future. I'm going to read up about this. I will watch videos about it. I will think about it. I will socialize it with my staff and my colleagues and my investors and my buyers. Let me figure out a plan to begin to do this. At least in part of my vineyards, at least in part of my supply chain. You learn by doing. I think sometimes it's a bit scary to just take a big leap. So, however much of people's vineyard they can change is much better than zero. And I believe that, agroforestry in wine has so many benefits, which are only going to become more apparent as we get more heat domes, more superstorms, windier climate, more droughts. I think that when people look into their heart and find the courage to try, just to try, the benefits will really be gobsmacking. And folks will fall in love with vitiforestry just the way I did.
Excellent. Well, that's a lovely place to end the podcast. Etel, thank you so much for your time. And particularly, thank you so much for all the hard work you've done in putting this drive, this compendium of best practice together. We'll make sure we get it out there to listeners. If you want to access it, listeners, just go to swroundtable.org, go to sustainablewine.co.uk. That's the online magazine of Sustainable Wine Roundtable, where we host these podcasts and so on. So you might be best finding the link on the podcast description, which we'll put out there. So if you'd like to get in touch with us to discuss it, please do so. You can reach me at Tobias at swroundtable.org. And I look forward to hearing from you. In the meantime, Etel, we'll do this again very soon. And thanks so much for your time today.
Thank you so much for having me. It was a pleasure.